NPR FM and the American Academy in Berlin present The Internet is Not the Answer, a special panel discussion from the European School of Management and Technology. I'm Jessica Hansen. Andrew Keen is an internet entrepreneur and author of several books, including The Cult of the Amateur and Digital Vertigo. His newest work, The Internet is Not the Answer, explores how the internet has shifted modern society and at what cost.
I look at this digital revolution and I'm deeply disappointed with what I see. I look at this digital revolution and I see more of what we were trying to escape.
In this special panel discussion, Keen, as well as German Federal Foreign Office's Cyber Policy Commissioner Norbert Rydell and cybersecurity expert Sandro Geiken, sit down to discuss whether the internet has changed society for the better. NPR brings you this discussion after the news. Next, Andrew Keen, author of The Internet is Not the Answer, gives his opening remarks.
Well, it's funny that the book Das Digital Debacle, I was amused when I saw that title because it's a lot more brutal, perhaps a lot more honest than The Internet is Not the Answer, which is a play on words. But they're all about the same subject. They're all about this issue in the book of an evaluation of the last 40, 50 years of the internet, but it's not an ideal word. I'm not really keen on that word. But everyone understands kind of what the internet is. But I'm writing about something broader, bigger. In the same way as now we talk about the Industrial Revolution, I'm describing, and in Germany, you guys have a natural understanding of grand historical moments, grand historical trends. You invented the whole discourse of historicism and ways of compartmentalizing history. I think we're living through something equally profound as the Industrial Revolution. And we can call it the internet, we can call it network society, we can call it the digital revolution. But whatever we call it, we know what we're talking about. We're talking about a grand historical disruption, a thing that's changing everything. Media it began with, the disruption of newspapers and radio, the music industry, which has been cut in half by 50% since 1999. And now again, as you guys know, in Germany, as well as anyone, the revolution, the network revolution, the digital disruption is extending to transportation with companies like Uber, hospitality, Airbnb, education, healthcare, government. Every industry, every profession is being profoundly transformed and disrupted by this great revolution. In many ways, we're living through as significant, as traumatic, as revolutionary a period as we did at the beginning of the 19th century. Indeed, since we're in Berlin, I can't avoid talking about 1989. You guys, of course, know 1989 as the year that Germany was unified, the wall came down, and Francis, and I write about this in some ways in the book, Francis Fukuyama famously said about 1989 that it represented the end of history. And in a sense, of course, he was right. It represented the end of the Cold War, the end of the great debate between communism and liberalism. But about a few hundred miles southwest of here in 1989, something else also happened, 6 months before November 1989, when the wall came down. In Geneva at CERN, Tim Berners-Lee, a young research student from Oxford, invented the World Wide Web, which sat on top of the internet, which enabled the popularization of the network, which represents really, even if Berners-Lee himself wasn't an entrepreneur, represents the commercial foundations of the web. And as I argue in the book, in Das Digitale Debakel, 1989 can be rethought, not as the end of history, not as the end of the great debate between communism and capitalism, not as the victory of liberalism, as Fukuyama imagined it, where we no longer had anything to argue about, but as the origins of a new debate, the origins of a new moment in history, the origins, of course, of this great digital revolution. So we're almost 50 years into it. The first computer-to-computer communication took place in 1969 at UCLA. A guy called Len Kleinrock was orchestrating this. So in about 4 or 5 years' time, we'll be celebrating really the 50th anniversary of the internet. Last year was the 25th anniversary of the web. We're into this. It's not like an adolescent anymore. We're not talking about a childhood. Some of my critics in America say, it's too early to tell. How can you evaluate the internet? My friend and enemy, Jeff Jarvis, some of you may know his work, a very entertaining and spirited commentator, argues that as with Gutenberg revolution in reading, it takes 50 or 100 or a couple of centuries to work this thing out. Maybe some of us can be patient enough, but unfortunately, unless Peter Thiel or some of these other singularity people are right, none of us are going to be around in a couple of centuries. And we're at a moment now where we can make some judgments. So the point of this book is to make some observations about what this revolution has done. The point of the book is to generalize about these grand historical trends. What is this revolution doing? Is it making the world a better place? In the first two chapters of the book, the first two historical chapters, I focus on what was promised, mostly by very well-meaning, publicly spirited research scientists, guys like Tim Berners-Lee, JCR Licklider. I tell the same story that my friend Walter Isaacson tells in The Innovators. We come to different conclusions, but we write about the same people. All these people believe that the internet, this digital revolution, would create what Licklider called a human-computer symbiosis. That it would make the world a better place. Kevin Kelly, I quote. John Perry Barlow wrote his famous Declaration of Independence from Cyberspace, at Davos 20 years ago. And everyone promised, all the evangelists, many of the technologists, all the early entrepreneurs, all the investors, they all said the same thing, that this would be a revolution that would compound democracy, create equal opportunity, destroy the old hierarchies of the industrial age, make things better, fairer, enable more people to do more things. And in economic terms, since we're at a business school, make us all collectively richer. And in this book, I make an analysis of the last 25 or 50 years. I look at this digital revolution, and I'm deeply disappointed with what I see. I look at this digital revolution, and I see more of what we were trying to escape. There are three main points I make in the book, three main areas where the internet, the digital revolution, network society is actually compounding the structural problems of late industrial capitalism. The first is the massive destruction of the middle class, this increasing polarization of a tiny group of extremely wealthy people, the so-called 1%, although in reality they're even less than the 1%, and the rest of the people. What we're seeing, and Piketty, some of you, I'm sure, you've all read his book, this is not just an internet phenomenon, but what I observe in the book is that digital society is creating a winner-take-all economy, a winner-take-all world in cultural and economic terms, where only a few people are winning. A small group of billionaires, a small group of blockbuster cultural stars. So if anything, Pareto's law now, the 80-20 law, has changed into the 99.9 law, where the digital society has actually compounded. Let me finish with a comparison of Kodak and Mark Zuckerberg, who now owns Instagram. The founder of Kodak, George Eastham was a rather eccentric entrepreneur, perhaps not unlike in some ways Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, but he was committed to the local community. He was committed to making things better in Rochester. I have a chapter in Rochester about its decimation now. But in Eastham's day, Rochester was a wonderfully thriving place, a place where, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people were employed by companies like Kodak. And what Eastham would do on a Sunday afternoon would open up his home and give classical concerts for Rochester citizens who would come in. He had a sense of responsibility, not just rights. He felt he needed to give something back. Now, maybe Mark Zuckerberg is an easy guy to pick on, but some of his behavior is so easy to pick on that it's unavoidable. In comparison with Eastham, Mark Zuckerberg, who is the evangelist of transparency and openness, who has famously said, if you're online and you should show your life, no one should have anything to hide, I've got nothing to be embarrassed with. Whereas Eastham opened up his home to the local community in Rochester, Zuckerberg bought his obligatory mansion in Palo Alto, which he has every right to. He's a very smart young man and a very rich young man. And then he bought the three houses adjoining that home to protect his own privacy. So he created a kind of cordon sanitaire around his house, the anti-Facebook. So compare the behavior of those two people, and I think it's in that behavior of Zuckerberg, in that stunning, astonishing hypocrisy, that we need to work on Silicon Valley. These people think or claim that they're making the world a better place, but they're really only making the world a better place for themselves. They're no better, they're no worse than any other large multinational corporation. And their argument that technology, by definition, makes the world a better place, more connected, more transparent, is deeply self-serving. So the time has come, I think, with books like this and in this debate, to transform the internet, which is dominated by this belief in the sort of intrinsic rights of people, to a sense of responsibility. We need to reshape digital society just as we did with industrial society. We need to engage with this new elite, and we need to insist that they become more responsible. Responsibility is the key here, because digital society is inevitable and unavoidable. By 2020, there'll be 50 billion connected devices. By 2025, practically everyone in the world, 95, 96% of the people in the world will be connected. So this revolution is only really still beginning, and it's reshaping every industry. And if we're back here in 2040, and these problems of inequality and unemployment and exploitation have become even worse, then we are indeed going to be in das digital debacle. Thank you.
You're listening to an NPR special from NPR and the American Academy in Berlin. The Internet is Not the Answer, featuring Internet entrepreneur and author Andrew Keen. More of this discussion in a moment. Next, Cyber Policy Commissioner for the German Federal Foreign Office Norbert Reidel and cyber policy expert Sandro Geiken respond to Andrew Keen's latest book, The Internet is Not the Answer. Also, the panel takes questions from moderator Christoph von Marschall.
First of all, I would like to say it's a great pleasure to meet you, Andrew Keen, and I read your book, and I can recommend it. And for the record, okay? And I think it should be an eye-opener for a lot of your readers. The title, the English title is "The Internet is Not the Answer." But what is the question? I don't see any question. Coming from the foreign policy perspective, I would say that the Internet transcends borders. That means it is a concern not for nations alone, but also for foreign policy, and that's why I'm coming in. I find that people are worried about two different things. On the one hand, there is a fear of an omnipotent state, big data leading into Big Brother. Here's what I think. I think that the state has an important role in internet governance, but there is one precondition, and it is trust. And unfortunately, because of the revelations of Edward Snowden, there is no more trust. But I think that governments or states, together with all stakeholders, with citizens, with private companies, with science, with international partners, have to make sure that there is an internet governance. On the other hand, I also sense that the public fears an impotent state. Searching for a restaurant with your iPhone or buying a book online, you have the slight feeling that Big Brother is watching you, and you have the question and you're wondering who really makes the rules. Is it the state or is it the big companies? So I think this is a quite important discussion, because what you described in your book, we have a discussion here in Europe, in Germany, and there's another discussion in the US, and we have to bring it together because it's relevant for our lives, and this is a very important policy issue.
But overall, more failure, more
No,
benefits?
I mean, from the foreign policy point of view, there are a lot of opportunities. Think about freedom of opinion. Think about how to bring information or education to the smallest village wherever in the world. It's a great opportunity. But at the same time, the internet has a lot of risks and challenges we have to deal with. So both, it's neutral.
Sandro, from your perspective, failure, benefit, how is the balance?
I go with Andrew's enemy and say it's too early to tell, actually, if, whether it's a failure or not. I think what we're witnessing now is a very typical historical process, in a way. If you're looking at technologies in the past, and more like the bigger ones, which are almost finalized in a final stage like industrialization, you always see that there's a phase zero or phase one, where some technology optimists, entrepreneurs, inventors have this great idea about the technology that can change the world. And just with industrialism, the promise was to free us all from labor and from poverty and these things. And so they start building this kind of machinery, and then it's gaining traction if it's useful. And then you need money, so big companies come in, investors come in with their own set of interests, and all these things. And then once the technology starts spreading out and becoming something which is really accessible and available for everybody, then everybody starts tinkering around with it, and then that's what changes technology. And I think there we are in a process right now where we're seeing a break from this very strongly utopian phase of the internet, where everybody thought it was great and make us richer and make us all free, liberate us, create one global community of peaceful, loving people. And I grew up with this community, so I know these utopian ideas very well, and which is now being changed because there are so many interests in there which are changing this whole paradigm. So we have a lot of interest in state surveillance, for instance, in countries like the whole Arab region, in China, Russia, who are really turning the internet into a machinery of control and propaganda. We're having a lot of economic problems with industrial espionage, for instance, through the internet in Europe. So quite a few of these utopian ideas are turned around now because there are more players, because the whole technology got broader and wider, and we have more people using it and abusing it. But I think this is just a step in between. So from a historical point of view, you do require some 25, 50 years or something for a technology to mature.
Let's move to the second question. What are the special threats or challenges, or however you put it? And it seems to me that here's a certain distinction, not only when we come to the question, what is a threat or who is the enemy or who is misusing it? And this is connected to the third question, where might be the solution? When I listen to Andrew Keen, there is a role for the government. But he didn't say the government is the enemy, the problem, the threat. He rather says, well, the free economy and what it is doing with the internet might be a threat to our societal model. Mm. When I look to the German discussion, it's mainly, well, the government is a threat. They are, or the governments. If it's not our own governments, then it's the other governments who are spying on us and so on. And there, of course, we have a... It's interesting that it's mainly an accusation of the United States, and the question what Russia or China does or whoever is somehow not there. But that just as a background, when we ask ourselves, from your perspective, when you are dealing with threats and challenges, what do you have first in mind?
Before I come to the threats, just one sentence for the good things, because that's what we are doing. We have a digital agenda here in the German government. We have it also in the European Commission, because we believe that the internet and the digital revolution is bringing labor, is bringing economic growth. So this is per se positive. But there are a lot of challenges and risks. I mean, in my day-to-day business, we start with privacy issue. I mean, that's... is one of the outcomes of the Snowden revelations. We have to make sure that we have privacy also in the internet. As we said, that human rights are offline as well as online. This is a new challenge because we have this internet as a new field of policy. On the other hand, Sandro Geigen just mentioned it. I mean, you have cyber criminality, cyber spying, cyber sabotage, and even the problem maybe cyber warfare. And so from my point of view, the internet is neutral, but like in the real world, you can have everything also on the bad side. And this means you can use the internet for every bad thing. And this is really a challenge because these are new risks and maybe we are lagging behind, because I also think that between states, between governments, we need some... standards, some regulations, some rules, but we can use the existing rules, but they were invented without knowing anything about internet, and now we have an internet. Creating new rules and regulations is very difficult, so maybe, as Sandro Geigen said it, it's too early, but there's a lot of pressure to go on, to find some solutions.
But I understand correctly, in your day-to-day work, you're rather concerned with privacy and the threat to privacy by governments or state actors. It's not so much that you are dealing with this field, which Andrew Keen mentioned, new monopolies, destroy the destroyers, and so on.
No, look, if there is mistrust between country, let's say it very blunt, after Snowden... the US is our closest ally. And if there's any kind of mistrust, we need each other. So this is related with this. But we always said it's not only about state and governments, it's also about the big enterprises. I mean, it's worrying because we have our own, let's say, society, our own social system. And now from Silicon Valley, there's coming a wave and we don't have an answer. I mean, there is a reason why we don't have in Germany, we don't have Amazon, Facebook, or Google. The only big German enterprise is SAP, but that's totally different. So there's a reason why we don't have this here in Germany. So something's happening, and the question also for us, for the government, is who makes the rules and how should we answer? Just one example. That's why Google is one important issue in Brussels, and can we find any solution in antitrust law or whatsoever. So, yes, these companies, it is a concern.
I'm sure we get to that later also, whether we have a European consensus, how we should deal with it or not. But first, let's ask the same question to you, Sandro. From your perspective, what are the threats? What are the challenges? What would you recommend to deal with mainly?
Well, I mean, right now, the things that I come from the warfare arena, the espionage arena, so my perspective is sort of coming from that field. But right now, I think while we're in this stage of transition from this highly utopian phase to a more realistic phase, the most dominant threats right now are the surveillance states which are coming up, and I don't mean the US and NSA, but much more Russia and China, the whole Middle East, North African countries, and these countries who are really using this tool in a very bad way. So that's a very big concern. Then, of course, everything you can do in terms of cyber warfare, cyber espionage, because there's a lot you can do with this. And there's a lot of states very interested in that. We're seeing a surge in activities and campaigns globally directed mainly against Europe, mainly against the United States. A lot of the industrial espionage activities are directed against Germany. And that, of course, is a systemic and a strategic threat to us and to our societies, and in as much to our economic system as to our political system.
So let's just jump to the third question. So where are the solutions? Well, generally, can we save the internet to pose a fundamental question? But then if we can save it, where do we start?
Yeah, I think we can. And we've been working actually on coming up or trying to come up with a couple of solutions, especially now in Germany, with this whole new paradigm of Industry 4.0 coming up, so the smart factory. That's actually one point where Germany is coming up prominently and featuring prominently in the whole IT world, which has never before really been the case, apart from SAP, of course. But now the machine world meets the IT world, and they're both getting together somehow. And Germany, at the moment, at least a lot of industries I'm talking to, are trying very hard to understand this, to wrap their minds around it, and to bring some of German engineering perspectives, German values, German perspectives on data protection as well to this world, because they have to, of course, to first sell it on the German market. And that in itself is the nucleus of a little change in this field, at least. It's not as fast as the Silicon Valley stuff. It's not as, doesn't have as much money as Silicon Valley, to be sure. And the whole innovation patterns are very different. In the Valley, you have a good idea, and then you go to one of these investor guys, Horowitz or something, and he gives you 10 million and then calls you back in 2 years. In Germany, when you have a good idea, you have to go through cycles and cycles and cycles of justification and complicated processes in getting money. That takes a bit longer, a lot longer, actually. It's much more critical, much more complex, but the outcome is much better. So our fail rate is much less, and maybe this different model of a value-sensitive, slow, critical, cautious innovation and evolution has a chance now that the Silicon Valley, as elegantly explained by Andrew, is sort of failing, and people around the world are seeing that this model is not good for them and that they need something new.
That will be an interesting question to you, Andrew, in the end as well, whether here is a difference between the German approach and so companies are smaller and we don't have this internet giants, whether the combination of German engineering and German values, as you put it, is a new answer. But first, Norbert Riedel, again to you. Can we save it, and where to start? And
First of all, we need governance. I think the internet needs governance, and this is not a task only for governments. We need all the stakeholders involved. Then I think we need some standards, and that's actually what we are doing in the United Nations and as well as the OSCE. We want to find consensus within governments, what is allowed, what is not allowed, what we should do, what we should not do, exactly for espionage or whatsoever. And I think there's also coming another argument. It's about maybe digital sovereignty. I mean, if we are not happy about what is happening, we have to find our own solutions. Sandro Geigen mentioned the Internet of Things or the Internet 4.0. But I think it's also about to be maybe more independent from big companies coming from the US or elsewhere. That's what we talk about, Schengen routing and other solutions. I mean, that's obvious. It has nothing to do with protectionism. It is just a reaction on what is happening. And I think we are thinking about that, and we are working on that.
And just for the record, or to have a better understanding, there are two very short questions, one on a detail, one on European policy. On the detail, I read in Andrew Keane's book the claim that Chancellor Merkel was sort of inventor or vordenker of a European internet as a competitor to the US-dominated World Wide Web, WWW, and now we should have a European net instead. From your, you worked in the Chancellery.
I mean,
was it Angela Merkel who came up with that idea, or?
That's a difficult question for me. No, I think there is no European internet or European whatsoever. But it's once again, it's quite normal that you start thinking about finding your own solutions if the solutions or the proposals you have on the table, if you don't like them. So it's obvious that you are thinking about that, and this is not very special, I think.
And the second, just on European policy, you have to deal with that every day. And when you said, well, we are trying to find consensus in the UN, that might be difficult since we are even not able, at least it seems to me, to find consensus inside the European Union. I mean, privacy and governments who are might be perceived as a threat to privacy. It seems to me that the French and the British have a very different approach to that than we Germans do, or at least the public perception is that there is a very different approach. How is that for you in day-to-day business? Do we have a consensus in Europe?
I mean, I think we made a big step forward coming up with a digital agenda, not only in Germany, but also within the European Commission. We are working on that. And just, for example, data protection, I'm quite sure that we will reach a solution within Europe within this year. And this is very important to bring forward the digital market. And so, I mean, it is difficult to have a common solution in Europe, but at the very end, it always works, and it comes to that. So I'm quite confident.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, your comments on the comments.
Well, they're very interesting. I think you brought up the trust issue, the trust. People always talk about the trust economy. And what you have with the internet has been the disintermediation of traditional authority, doing away of gatekeepers, the idea that trust would somehow naturally form. And I think one of the challenges, the cultural challenges of the internet, is that as this, and this is why this is a sort of a grand historical narrative, we have the undermining of the traditional institutions, traditional professions, journalism, for example, teachers, lawyers, accountants, doctors, they're all challenged by this new world. But one of the great victims in this world is trust. No one trusts anything. We live increasingly in a culture of paranoia, a culture, and maybe perhaps slightly less so in Europe than in America, but a culture dominated by more and more extreme conspiracy theorists. The internet hasn't created that paranoia or that conspiracy theory, but it's contributing to it. And as you have this disintermediation of the traditional authorities, the traditional expertises of the 20th century. As journalists, for example, maybe less so in Germany, but certainly in America, as journalists have less authority, as everyone's reliant on their own social network, we have firstly a culture where we only trust the people we agree with in the first place, and increasingly you have this fragmented, atomized, alienated culture. All we're left with is the self, or perhaps all we're left with is the selfie. So there is certainly a scarcity of trust. And ironically enough, everyone always talks about the attention economy, the trust economy, the attention economy. The other casualty in this world is attention. This is a great audience. Most of you are actually listening to what we're saying. You're not tweeting. You're not on your computers. If we were in America, especially in Silicon Valley, people would be on their phones. They'd be networking. One of the cultural casualties of this, I write about it in the book, is a tyranny of the present, a tyranny of the now. Jérôme Lanier famously said, "I miss the future." And I agree, I miss the future, but I also miss the past. And I think there is, alongside all the economic problems of the internet and the political problems, a cultural problem of this endless now, this tyranny of the moment, where the mob rampages from Twitter outrage to Twitter outrage, and no one's able to concentrate on anything. And I think that comes back to the casualty of attention and trust.
You're listening to The Internet is Not the Answer from NPR and the American Academy in Berlin. Cyber policy expert Sandro Geiken, cyber policy commissioner Norbert Reidel, and author Andrew Keen are discussing the Internet's effect on society. In a moment, Keen gives his closing remarks. Next, cyber policy commissioner for Germany's Federal Foreign Office, Norbert Reidel, on why Germans are so worried about internet surveillance. Also, Andrew Keen's closing remarks on his latest book, The Internet is Not the Answer.
What's the difference, or why are the Germans so worried about surveillance and mass data collection compared to U.S. citizens? I mean, we are here in this building. This has a certain history from the State Council, from the former GDR. And 1989, when the internet was invented, at the same time, the Berlin Wall came down. So it's about history, and we have our own history, and that's why we are a little bit, or not only a little bit, it is an issue for us. But let me be very clear. I think some in Germany forgot that there is a difference if government is collecting data. Government, which came out from a democratic election, controlled by parliament, controlled by judges, or if it is a big company like Google collecting mass data without any control. And this is worrying, I think. This is really worrying, and that's what Andrew Keen also mentioned in his book. If we need governance for the internet, could this happen? I mean, first of all the rules in the real world should also be applied in the internet. But the internet is very complicated, and there are new questions. We don't have answers yet. But that doesn't mean that you cannot find any kind of governance for the internet. There is an international discussion going on. It's about who defines the rules of the internet. If the internet is what is ruling our life, what is making the world turn around, then who is making the rules? Is it the Chinese way, the Russian way, the American way, or is it the European way? There is a discussion. But our feeling or our conviction is that it's not only up to the governments, because once again, even if the governments say you should do this, you should not do this, if nobody cares in the internet, what happens? Nothing. So we need all the stakeholders. That is a very complicated process, and that is a new process. There was in Sao Paulo, there was the Net Mundial initiative, where after these revelations, all the stakeholders met in Sao Paulo and tried to come to a consensus about some rules which should be applied to the internet. This is very complicated, and I can assure you, if you're going to a conference and you have some thousand of people coming from all these stakeholders, and they are discussing, but at the very end, who is deciding the rules? But you need consensus, I think. And I mean, I'm coming from the foreign policy. I'm not an expert about talking about the fourth revolution or the economical value, but I think the digital agenda, it underlines how important the internet, the digital revolution, is for our economy, for our society. And I'm also really convinced that we in Europe, and especially in Germany, we have very good solutions, and this will help our economy in the future. And just the last thing, Schengen routing, I just give you one example. If you have a medium-sized enterprise in the middle of Germany, they never go global. They are producing something, and then they have a second production site. They have to transfer data, and this is their knowledge. And if this enterprise doesn't want that anybody got this data, so it's a question, if they send an email with all these data, is it staying within Germany or within Europe, or is it going wherever? You know, you don't know it, because maybe it's going via US, maybe it's going through other countries, and somebody could interfere and take this data. So I think this is a quite normal question, and why not? So this is possible, but other things, yeah, maybe they are not possible, they don't make sense. We have a globalized internet, but we have both solutions.
Well, Andrew, if this seems to you like a cultural shock, because I'm pretty sure that some of these questions wouldn't be asked in Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. and also some of the concerns you heard from our German yeah. panelists wouldn't be so big concerns. This was a moderate version, because we are here in German-American audience and not the typical only German audience. So please, I'm interested, but you have to say.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful discussion. I really enjoyed it. I have to say, without wishing to sound too rude, that, and I can be very rude, I hate that word stakeholder, because any time it ever gets uttered, basically what it says is nothing is ever going to get done. It's just an excuse to allow lots of people to say something, and then nothing ever to get done. So I would suggest we come up with a better word than stakeholder. It just sort of, I went to one of those UN internet meetings. I had to do a debate with Vince Cerf. I thought it was a complete waste of time. I mean, just utter waste of money and time. And, you know, World Internet Forum, by definition, is useless. I mean, it is about as, you know, it's like the United Nations or something. Nothing ever gets done, and meanwhile, you know, going back to Silicon Valley, everything moves forward with remarkable pace. So let's change our language. You know, Orwell, of course, was brilliant on that, and I think stakeholder is one of those words which have, with that its lack of meaning actually has rich meaning.
Well, what's your alternative?
I don't know. I'm asking you. You're the politician. You're paid to get stuff done, right? I assume, or maybe paid not to get stuff done. So let me come back to the fourth revolution, because I think that's a really interesting question. I deal with it a little bit in my book. So in the beginning, we had this revolution of broadcasting and media. We were told, you take away the means of production, you democratize the means of production, everyone could be a broadcaster, everyone could be a radio, anyone could make radio. Anyone could put music on the internet. Anyone could blog. And this was supposed to democratize media. And as I show in my book, it actually hasn't. It's created an even narrower elite, cultural elite, a tiny proportion of dominant bloggers. Again, the laws of the winner-take-all economy on the internet lends itself to more inequality. So coming back to this fourth industrial revolution, it's a really important question. And I thought your point was fascinating. We all know what this fourth revolution is. In very vulgar terms, we have the democratization of production. The factory becomes personalized. You have these things called 3D printers, which sit on our desks, and we all get our personalized factory. So in theory, of course, firstly, maybe, you know, every German has some uniquely, Teutonic ability in engineering, so that maybe this makes their desktop factories more efficient or effective than the American ones. But what I fear is, okay, we have the old oligarchies of Mercedes and BMW and Bosch, but actually what will happen with this 3D printing revolution is you're going to have even narrower platforms. So my prediction will be that you have people like Jeremy Rifkin arguing that we're going to have this sort of idealized post-capitalist economy in which everyone can become a factory owner. The truth is that we will have a Google or a Facebook or an eBay or a dominant or an Airbnb or an Uber, a dominant platform in this world, which will make things even more of a even more inegalitarian. So I fear that the supposed democratization of production will actually have, and I talk about this a lot in the book, the unintended consequences of a tinier and tinier narrow elite. Again, not because the internet's evil or technologists are evil, but this technology lends itself to a winner-take-all economy. So I think it's a fascinating question, and I think your point is really interesting, because clearly the Germans excel at manufacturing. But the old German industrial economy was a top-down manufacturing economy. So you excel in the old corporate industrial structures. So the challenge for Germans and German entrepreneurs is, can you make the transition from that old world to this new world? And maybe you can. I just want to end. There was a lady here who said something really interesting. And the other, two Americans, they talked about Airbnb, and they said, what the people want. What do the people really want? So what do the people really want with, say, Airbnb? They want to rent out their homes, and I disagree with local politicians here. I think they should be able to rent out their homes. And, you know, Uber allows people to get cabs easily. That's not a bad thing. But the problem with these things is they are massive financial plays, attempts to replace Avis and Hertz, which now Uber is worth a lot more, attempts to replace Hilton and Marriott, which Airbnb is now worth a lot more. And what we have, the new danger, are the platform monopolies. And we have it with Uber as an example. Everyone, yeah, wants to get a cab easily. But what people don't want to be in a situation where Uber becomes the monopoly, replaces every little cab company in the world. So when it rains or when it snows, the fares go up 10x. Or they don't want to be in a situation where they sit in an Uber car and the guy driving them has just got out of jail and is a serial rapist because they haven't done any checks. So this idea of what the people want, I think, is extremely simplistic and, of course, reduces everything to a culture of rights. So if you take the example of Airbnb, what does everyone want? Everyone wants to be able to rent out their home, bring in some extra income, which isn't a bad thing, which maybe reflects the new structure of the economy. But the problem with Airbnb, and this has been well documented in New York City by the attorney in New York State by the attorney general. I write about it in my book. Eric Schneiderman is a huge proportion. It's something like 60 or 70% of the renters on Airbnb aren't paying their taxes. They're not giving this money back because this culture of rights means that they don't feel they have any kind of obligation to give back. So it's not that Airbnb is wrong, the culture's wrong, it needs to be regulated. It shouldn't be regulated out of existence. But this idea of everything should be as the people want treats the people as infants, and they're not. We need more responsibility. Let me end with Amazon, because I think Amazon is the ultimate parable of what people want. I always think Amazon's kind of like pornography, maybe not in Germany, but in America, we all use it, but no one admits it. Amazon on one level is amazing. It's what people want. They want incredibly efficient service, they want remarkably good prices, and they want a wonderful web interface. It's a fantastic product, a superb product. It never lets you down. So it's what people want. But on the other hand, we've all made this arrangement. It's, again, we're in Germany, where you will understand what a Faustian bargain means. And what does it mean? We get what we want with Amazon, sure. We get unnaturally low prices. We get incredibly efficient delivery. But what's the cost, the social cost? The social cost is increasingly hostile labor arrangement, where Amazon production houses are, they're not slave labor, but they're certainly extremely unpleasant, where labor is exploited, a strong culture of anti-unionism. I write about it again in some detail in my book. That's not what people want. We don't want a world where people sit in production, in distribution centers, a kind of a new Walmart, a digital version of Walmart, which is exactly what Amazon is. And what else has Amazon resulted in? It's decimated independent bookstores. So it means now there are half as many independent bookstores in America than there were when Amazon started. That's not what we want. And Amazon now is increasingly a monopoly in publishing. So Amazon now is bullying small publishers. They even have a term for it. It's called gazelle. And they think of themselves as the lion, which eats the gazelles. And that's bad for all of us, not just for publishers, because it means there are fewer books. Writers are not able to make a living. So this idea of what people want is too simplistic. There have been lots of polls saying, is the internet good for society? And everyone in America says yes, because they're not thinking this thing through. They're not really thinking about the social consequences. So Amazon is a great company. I acknowledge it, and Jeff Bezos is a brilliant man. But he has forced us into these kind of Faustian bargains, and he's seduced us with his cult of the consumer. Everything is for us. Everything's for the consumer. But it isn't really, because we're not just consumers. We're citizens as well. And from the point of view of being citizens, what Amazon is doing and what Uber is doing and what Airbnb is doing is not good for us. So again, I think we need to think about these things more broadly. I'm against laws which don't allow these companies. I think that's as unhealthy as an absence of laws which don't control them at all. But we need a middle ground. We need some regulation. And we need all of us to really think carefully about what we want. Because often what we really want isn't as immediate as what we think it is. And we need to think more about the long-term consequences of this revolution. Because as with Amazon, we get wonderful service and very, very cheap books. But when we think about the long-term consequences, I'm not convinced it's really what we want.
Thank you. So with regard to the time, let me wrap this up with four last comments. The first one, small advice, you have bodyguards with you?
Absolutely, yeah.
Don't mess with the UN when you are in Germany, and don't make jokes about the UN. It's a holy thing for Germans, the United Nations. Okay?
Is it?
Oh, yeah. That's we are not in an American audience where you can make easy jokes about the UN and everybody is laughing here. This is a really serious thing, the United Nations, okay? Second,
just joking.
We learned something about questions. The most important thing about questions is not that you get an answer. The most important thing about questions is that you are able to ask the questions, because questions are sometimes more important than the answers. Third thing, if that's what you really want, now is your occasion to buy the book and let Andrew sign it. That's what you really want. And the last thing, I thank the panel, a wonderful panel, for a lot of interesting insights and also competing ideas and approaches how we deal with this, and I thank you that you came, that you were patient. Have a good way home, Arthur.
You've been listening to The Internet is Not the Answer, an NPR special from NPR and the American Academy in Berlin. Thanks to Sandro Geiken from the European School of Management and Technology, Norbert Reidel from the Federal Foreign Office, Christoph von Marschall from Der Tagesspiegel, and author Andrew Keen for participating. For more information on NPR Berlin, visit nprberlin.de. To learn more about the American Academy in Berlin, go to americanacademy.de. Thanks to the European School of Management and Technology, Kingsley Smith, Mitch Eaton, Jerry Tennant, Alex Curley, and Sasha Rindesbacher for production assistance.